Hey everybody, this is Kirk Barbero with RV Odyssey, and I have Patrick Reasonover of he's a partner at Just Add Firewater Productions, and he and I met because he is the co-founder and president of Taliesin Nexus. And I've actually been to two of their workshops. I think I was there pretty early on. I think I was 2012, and you guys founded in 2010, right?
That's right, though. You were definitely very early on because we were chartered, I think, like December 29th of 2010. So really, 2011 was our first year. So yeah. You came to our second year.
I think I was the second one. Yeah. And I was like, wow, they have some really big players here. I learned a lot. I learned about pitching. So the idea of Taliesin Nexus, I'll let you kind of talk a little bit about it to get us started. We're going to, by the way, everybody, we're going to talk about culture and literature. And Patrick and I have connected over Gone with the Wind. I don't know if you remember, that's my favorite novel. I know that's one of your favorite novels too. And, you know, the idea of how art and especially literature, in my view, and movies can impact a culture and really change a culture in a more positive or in a direction. And hopefully if you have the right ideas, you're moving in a positive direction. But before we get into that, I wanted to start by kind of going into Taliesin Nexus and to kind of see what you're doing over there. Because, I mean, you guys have gotten pretty big. Like, I was like, they have like six seasons of shows now. And I'm like, damn, now I've been in San Antonio. Now I'm all over the place in my RV. And it's like, man, I want to go to LA again. Like, it's making me want to get involved with what you guys are doing. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Taliesin Nexus, the mission? It's one that attracted me in 2012. And I can, you know, say I was there at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kurt, really appreciate you inviting me on your show. I really love the idea of talking about literature and film and, you know, how storytelling impacts culture, impacts how people think, impacts their, you know, just their decision making, you know, who they are. Yeah. It's incredible the level of, you know, impact that has on you. But yeah, so we created the nonprofit in 2010, really 2011. And we've been growing it, and our focus has always been on taking these like fundamental, you know, ideas of Western civilization, like, you know, like individual liberty or, you know, rule of law, these kind of things that basically undergird our civilization, these institutions, and helping people, you know, explore those in film because they need to evolve through time. And so the way these institutions evolve through time, especially in our understanding of them, is through narrative, where you have these institutions, but you also have what's happening now and like what people are going through in their daily lives and how that, you know, relates and intersects. And so, I would advise, if anyone's interested in our organization, to check out our about page. You know, one of the things we've done recently to kind of, you know, probably refocus might be the right word is, you know, when it comes to making content like this, there's often like a political sense to it, right? Where it's, oh, well, you're a part of this tribe or you're a part of that tribe. And, you know, if you're not making my tribe stuff, then I'm not interested in you and what you do. And, you know, maybe you're even like making stuff that, you know, is, you know, against my tribe. And what we wanted to do is really position so much as just accurately explain what we really want to do. And that is to produce, you know, have talent development programs where if you want to come in and you kind of believe with us or share with us like three core values of individuality and liberty, where people need to be free to pursue their own happiness and to, you know, gain from the fruits of their labor and to trade with others, but then also community and compassion. So, you know, when you're an entrepreneur and I'm an entrepreneur, you know, yes, you're interested in what you're doing, but what you're doing, if you're passionate about it and it, you know, it's something that, it, you know, in a capitalist free market system, it's something that other people are buying. You know, it's a value to them to, you know, what you're doing. So, you know, so in some ways, like what your mission is born out of a sense of your own personal pride and individuality and freedom, but also a sense of how is this helping other people, you know, in a positive way or producing a positive impact long term for, you know, your society, your civilization. And then the third one is innovation, And innovation is just how a society moves forward. And if we have a society where, you know, we don't have innovation happening, well, then we have a stagnant or even a dead society. And so for us, that story of, you know, liberty and individuality and community and compassion fueling innovation, that's really what we want. People who feel a shared sense of identity with that story. And when they come into the organization, we have film labs where you can get between $10,000-$15,000 grant to go make a film that, you know, explores those ideas, you know, ideas that, you know, even undergird those values like integrity, stewardship, honor, you know, empathy, pride, you know, a lot of those just really basic values that I feel, you know, in our culture, these are the lions or the studios, I think, like, sort of drift away from that to be what is the popular topic of the moment, or let's make superhero movies. So we have an opportunity for people coming into our program to really focus on a social issue or, you know, a values issue that they're really passionate about and make something that's really amazing that, you know, can touch the lives of others when they get the chance to see it. So that's kind of what the organization is about, just finding people who share this sensibility and want to explore work, our stories and narrative in that space, and then, you know, hopefully use the work that they generate to help them in their long-term career as a storyteller.
Yeah, so it's a development. It started as a development program, but you guys have kind of expanded from there, right? Where you're... You know, when I did it, the workshops were, you know, you submit a screenplay. I submitted a screenplay. I don't know if you were doing novels at the beginning, so I don't know if I submitted a novel. But now you're like, you have a literary magazine, Cinder Q, which I just subscribed to. That's not true. I just downloaded the app a couple of days ago and checked back into it. I'm submitting stuff to it, so we'll see what happens. But it's, you know, it's cool. It's like good to have places, other places than just, you know, the traditional mainstream. And you guys are emphasizing different values that, you know, you're interested in. And I think that, you know, paves the way for, you know, great artists to have avenues that where they don't have to fit in to a certain, you know, party line or fit into a certain tribe. Like you said, there's other places that they can go and one, get nurtured. So if you're an author that you feel like you maybe don't fit into the traditional normal Hollywood, you know, type, and you're going to find difficulty, and you will find, I mean, even people who fit in find difficulty in Hollywood. So if you don't fit in, it's really hard to make it in Hollywood, I think, or in any arts today in media. So I think, like, there needs to be these Talias and Nexuses. And hopefully this is, like, you know, the beginning of a whole new trend of this kind of thing that, you know, there's like an umbrella of you guys creating and, these institutions and organizations that support and foster young artists who don't fit into that tribe. But I thought, you know, the normal tribe of what, you know, maybe Hollywood has, but I thought we could talk a little bit and kind of move into, culture at large and how literature impacts it. Because I think this is the soul of Talias and Nexus, and everything that you do there is, you know, like you were saying before, is you have these pillars and you're nurturing these artists, trying to give them, the opportunity to develop. But you also, you know, your view is that if you give them the opportunity to be innovative, that they can create something and develop their career, which again will eventually have a positive impact on society, on the people around them, on themselves. So, but let's you know, talking about Taliesin as well, but let's like take away for a second. How exactly like does a piece of literature, you know, whether a book, or, you know, a novel, or a series of novels, like a whole movement, let's say, you know, how do you look at the impact that art specifically has on a culture?
That's a great question. You know, I come from a background of philosophy and creative writing. That's what I studied in college. It's kind of what's always motivated me. And so you have something that's like very interesting where you have this rationalistic approach when it comes to philosophy, you know, reason. And then you have this very imaginative approach when it comes to writing. And those sort of things seem like oil and water in a sense, you know, right? Like if there's too much philosophy and reason and deduction in a novel, it just rips you out of the experience. It feels like someone's preaching to you or trying to get you to adopt their view. And it doesn't really like enlighten you, you know? And then with a story, you know, you can just tell an entertaining story, but if I sort of walk away from it, you know, like just a detective thriller, well, I just sort of spent some time doing something, but I didn't really, you know, it didn't necessarily affect my soul. And a place where I think that the two come together is in this idea of wisdom. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a kind of philosophy that it explores wisdom and the human condition and what it means to be a human being and you know, and have relationships. And, you know, and have these values like we're interested in. And then when it comes to, the narrative storytelling, I mean, narrative storytelling is how human beings have transmitted their culture, and their identity and their habits and ways of being and even memory throughout time. Like, throughout time, it has been the number one vehicle and means of communicating. Whereas, you know, kind of reason, a reflective, you know, consciousness tool evolved much later. And I feel like our brains both do both things. And so when we have a culture and, you know, it seems as though in the news media or in politics or whatever, people are just arguing, you know, they're just arguing.
Talking heads.
It's all very ideological. And it's just sort of tribe signaling. And you don't really feel like we're moving forward. It feels like we're getting farther apart. And so
that's definitely, I'm with you.
Yeah. And so I'm coming at something from my ideology and you're coming at it from your ideology. And then we have different, then it's almost just like we can never come together. Nothing can unite us. But what can unite people is a shared experience. Mm-hmm. You know, just like in real life, you know, you go out with someone on some kind of camping trip or you go through an experience with someone at, like on a film or at work. You have a shared experience. What a story does is it can give like a shared experience to millions of people at once. So, and that's really, really pretty incredible.
Yeah. Are you a fan of Westerns, of classic Westerns by any chance?
Oh, yes, I am a fan of Westerns. And, you know, speaking of literature, I think it's that the book True Grit.
Okay.
I recently read that about last year, and I was just, I wish someone had recommended that to me in high school.
Oh,
it is a fantastically written book. It's in dialect and not in a really cheap way, like, you know, Mark Twain, where you're influencing the way people, you know, the words to the nouns to make them sound, you know, when read, like how they would actually sound, but rather just through word selection and word order.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful novel and a great Western. And, I've
never read the book. I've seen both movies, of course. I'm a fan of Shane, the book and the movie. If you've ever read that one, that's a classic. But I mean, the reason I'm asking about Westerns is, one of the things that those directors, John Ford and many of the original directors and producers, Howard Hawks at that time, like a lot of these guys, they were trying to, I think they were trying to do something not maybe a little slightly different, but something similar to what you were doing. Like the way they put it, was they wanted to create a mythos for America. You know, America was a new country and they wanted to develop the myth of America. And that's why they focused, because their Westerns were there from the beginning of film. Like the first official narrative film, The Great Train Robbery, is a Western essentially, or in a certain sense. And there's a lot of Westerns. I mean, John Wayne did Westerns all through the late 20s, early 30s. But it wasn't until 1939 with Stagecoach, Gone with the Wind, you know, I had to bring that up again, you know, that we get a whole new, what is considered generally the Renaissance. And a lot of this was like second generation filmmakers, like John Ford, his cousin was a Western filmmaker. And they were explicitly saying that we want to create what America is. And I think they succeeded. I mean, they succeeded. Even though their explicit goal was to make these mythologies of America, And, you know, John Wayne being the greatest of them all in the sense that he was America. Like, I think it's hard for us to really comprehend how much John Wayne really was America. Like, everyone thought abroad that we were just a bunch of John Waynes in America.
Right. And, not a terrible thing for people to think.
No. I mean, I think a lot of people today would disagree with you, but I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's John Wayne had a lot of virtues that were great in the films that he made. And True Grit being a very interesting one in that whole progression of what happened. Cause that was a kind of a later one after like Searchers. And there's like an interesting progression of the mythos of John Wayne that we can get into. But the interesting thing is that, you know, in terms of impacting the culture, is one, I think they definitely succeeded, right, by creating great art. And so I'm wondering, one of the big differences, though, is that there were less media than there is today. So they had their own challenges of creating this great art that got to the masses, right? Like, that's what film did, was it was considered the art of the masses. And so the upper class at first thought it was ridiculous. But now we have a completely, you know, developed Hollywood system, or system in general. Even if you're not in Hollywood, you're still probably using their system when you're making a film. So I'm curious, like, where do you see it possible to create a new kind of mythos of some sort, you know, like if there were to be like a cadre, a team of great producers who just pumped out great content that, you know, created something that really inspired, you know, America to be what it was, or to be something new, even better, you know, because there was obviously problems in it. So I'm just curious, like, you know, it seems like you're starting that kind of movement with Taliesin and everything you're doing. So I'm curious your thoughts, you know, on Westerns and the impacting of the culture today with new media. Because new media, billions of bits of content is the point I'm trying to make, right?
Yeah, that's right. Wow, so that's a lot of stuff there. So so one on the Western. The Western's definitely about what is America. The first Western published book, I believe, was The Virginian by Owen Wister. And what you generally always have is a Southerner post the Civil War, who has moved out to remake himself in the West. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have a lot of prototypical cowboys, you know, of that variety, you know, in like Clint Eastwood, Josie Wales, you know, it's like that's, and then The Virginian, I think it was published in 1902. That is that's the character. He's also the man with no name. You know, yeah. Clint Eastwood is also the man with no name. The Virginian is always referred to as the Southerner or the Virginian. And then when he's in the West, he meets the schoolmarm, the New England schoolmarm. So it's after this devastating war that really was about what is America, and, you know, was sundered into pieces. And then there's a move to the West where we can re-find America again. It can be remade through this partnership of the North and the South, or you know, it's just this fulfilling of things, and then and sort of a rebirth in the West. Mm-hmm. And so I think the West often focuses on justice, definitely also focuses on questions of honor. It focuses on how do people behave when a government is not necessarily there telling them what to do.
Yeah.
And what do they do when that is the case? And you sort of see the worst in man and the best in man and women, you know, in that circumstances. So like, it really is like the American mythology, space, I think there, Westerns, but, a format and a flowering, a cultural flowering like the one you described, or a Renaissance, also depends on the audience. It's not just something that the individuals can just generate and do. There is a zeitgeist component to that. And I think one of the things that I would just criticize about where we're at, or just give a perspective on, like a group of producers having such a huge impact now, is I think that we're seeing a flowering being inhibited. You know, for all of the amount of voices that there are in, you know, social media, you just look at the number of films that are being made by Hollywood, like how many they used to make, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and that kind of thing, versus how many they make now. The focus now is not America. It's a global audience.
Yes.
I mean, they're looking to make projects with big IP like Superman, Batman, Star Wars, Star Trek, something that people all over the world recognize, Jungle Book.
Even dialogue has reduced, right? Like there's less dialogue, so it could be easily translated.
Yeah, and the special effects component, that's like a big deal. And so, and then the other thing you get with the loss of the dialogue, and you know, with your market, if your number one market is China, you know, how much of your content is going to be focused on dealing with American issues or dealing with, you know, what it means to be an American? You know, it's not. And in fact, you may wind up finding yourself making terrible compromises, as they have, you know, when they're shooting in China or these other places, for China to distribute the film. You know, as my understanding is, you can't show the streets dirty. The cops always must get the guy. You know, and so you're going to get notes and pushback if you don't find that. So, you know, Hollywood, for very good financial reasons, has seemingly moved in a direction of let's make $500 million movies that make $1 billion, that we get a lot, most of our revenue, perhaps even way more of our revenue from China and India and other and Europe. And, you know, America's just a piece of the pie. But
small piece.
But and sometimes it is definitely a small piece.
No, I'm being serious. It's like smaller than China.
But then if you're a storyteller in America, you know, and you're an American, you know, part of the whole thing about storytelling is it's an incredibly important career. It is an incredibly impactful career, because how do you learn about who you are? You know, you have your family and your peers, but that shared culture of these narratives that go, you watch them and they go into your memory. And then, you know, when you're confronted with a situation, you know, your memory and imagination sends up scenarios about what you should do, what's right and wrong. And that, like, shared storytelling culture that we have is incredibly important to, like, the evolution of people living here right now. So I think that we're maybe going to see, you know, a flowering of a lot of these independent films that are going to come up, because the studios are sort of moved out of the space, you know, because from a financial standpoint, it's not as good for them. And I think that we're seeing a lot of, you know, these efforts to fund, you know, at a smaller scale, feature films, documentary content that are very socially relevant and very enlightening.
Well, let me ask you this. So I agree with everything you're saying. I think that's important for, you know, maybe that's just what Hollywood becomes. It's just, that's part of what Hollywood is. And there's another branch, you know, that leaves an opportunity for Americans to have a better kind of entertainment for them. I think, by the way, I think Netflix originals are doing a lot of that. Like that, it's like a book, some of these things, like Stranger Things, you know, these are like actually in chapters. And I think you're going to see more and more of that. I'm excited about the future of media for a lot of reasons, including what you said. And I'm curious, because I've been in social media a lot for the past 5 years now. I've pretty much made a living at it for years and years. And I'm very bullish on this, what you're saying, the flowering and happening on social media, just because of the number of things that, like, the creative abilities and freedom that I can see in some of these channels. Like, I think we're still at the beginning of what social media is. I mean, to me, it's very much like the chaos of the early film years, when you have like Biograph and like, you know, the Edison companies and such. And they're like these, they have these big behemoths that come together with General Film. But then you have these little independents just like going off to California and saying, screw you. Although they were kind of stealing stuff, but that's another story. but they were just they only cared about really making art to some degree at the beginning and doing it their way. I see that with social media, but go ahead.
One thing I had a thought about the social media I wanted to post to you. I remember you and I had a conversation a couple of years ago about, you know, when Ayn Rand came to the United States, it was almost a bit in the infancy of the film.
I wrote an article for Smash Cut Culture.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And that was a great exploration of that. Yeah, it was, she came out, and what if she had come now?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like, would, I think a lot. Yeah, she would.
Poop star?
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe she would have tried to write for Netflix, but she definitely would not have tried to go down the original route. Like, she was excited about something that was at the time freaking new. It was brand, like, she was born in 1905. And the film industry didn't really flower until the teens.
Yeah.
And she heard about it in like 19, she moved to America in like 1921, got a job like with Cecil B. DeMille right away as an extra. But she came because of film. That's why. And yeah. She didn't want to die in Russia. That was the other reason. But you know, like yeah. Still, it's a good reason. Well, it's
the people moving to Silicon Valley now to work in, you know, tech. It's like a similar thing. It's like, whoa, this stuff is really new.
But I think, you know, like, so here's the
very
difference.
New.
They need to work. So this is why they need to find, you know, organizations like yours, because one of the problems is that even like things accelerate way faster. So it's, and we have government problems. So like, I think it's way, like when you read Ayn Rand's story, she like, you know, stayed with some cousins. Like she didn't have any money, but she also didn't have to pay like, you know, the rent that you have with controlled rent in especially in San Francisco. Oh my God, man. It is, you can't go to Silicon Valley and live there. Like you have to know somebody or have a good job because like, for instance, I got an RV to kind of stay away from that, but there's laws that follow me around because they're like, I don't like you in your RV. And there are other, there's over a million RVers now full time in America. And, I like it. Like, it's a great way to, you know, I'm not gonna do it forever, but it's a great way to kind of, you know, explore and get into more places that I wouldn't normally be able to. My point is simply that it's a little more difficult, but we have this ability to reach out to Elias and Nexus to apply for these things. Maybe, you know, that you could work together. Like, if you're not in LA right now, maybe start something on your own there and work with Elias and, you know, create something with your iPhone. I mean, I'm always telling people, like, just create with what you got and build from there. So anyway, I'm excited about, you know, Elias and Nexus and the impact you can have if you can continue, and not if, I'm sure you will, but continue nurturing all over the country these creators that are, you know, going to make, make the next Atlas Shrugged or whatever it is that impacts the culture. Yeah. Or Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, what you're saying about the regulatory aspect. So yeah. So
it's
with,
annoying, man.
Well, my production company, just at Firewater, we have a project right now. It's a big feature documentary on innovation and regulation. Mm-hmm. And so we went into some of the companies that are doing some of the most amazing stuff you wouldn't believe. Like, so cell cultured meat, where they're, you know, basically like making animal meat just from taking a biopsy from an animal that's still alive. And the prospect would be that they can, you know, sort of cheaply print these, you know, animal protein of any kind without the killing of an animal.
Huh.
So we would maybe be on the cusp within decades of.
Oh, I think I've heard of this. Like where you're creating meat in a.
Basically. That is exactly
okay,
right.
Okay.
Culture. They develop a vegetable amniotic fluid that the cells, you know, live in until they get sort of big enough, and then at that point they expand geometrically. So, you know, if you have 1 ton, it's 2 tons. If you have 2 tons, it's, you know, it's 4 tons and 8. I mean, I'm not a math person. I'm a philosophy person. But anyway, the point is like once you reach a certain stage,
yeah,
you are. You know, we don't need to have animal slaughter. We don't need to eat.
And you wipe out hunger across the world.
Right. You wipe out. We would literally
wipe out famine.
Wipe out famine and hunger. Yeah. And not at just the level of like bread, but like meat, animal protein. And then we have another, one of our other stories is aquaculture. So it's about this group that are actually based out in the open ocean, between Catalina and Los Angeles, the first federally permitted aquaculture farm. So they're growing kelp and, mussels and other filter feeders. Hmm. And so it just like, when you look at the math, if they're able to farm the oceans using these materials, what's interesting about kelp and filter feeders is they clean the ocean. They don't need fertilizer. They don't need anything like that. They clean the ocean. Almost like a kind of terraforming thing when you think about it. And they clean and they improve the ocean. And then all the you know, with the products that you can pull out of kelp and the mollusks, or, you know, whether you're eating them or not, it's, there's like replacements for a lot of different things that we use. It's really phenomenal. You know, it's pretty incredible. And they just, the kelp grows basically like 2 feet a day. And you just sort of harvest it, and it just keeps going. Wow. And Yeah, and they create whole ecosystems in the open ocean, because the open ocean is a desert. There's like it's like the Sahara of water on most of this ocean. And so if we can go in and start creating, you know, these kind of things, it you know, we're literally bringing water to the desert. And we did another story on 3D printed organs. They basically will take a biopsy of your liver and print you an organ. And then also carbon trees.
I want to live forever. Carbon. Yeah.
These carbon eating plastic trees. So this scientist has devised a means of creating this, you know, through taking this plastic or, polymer resins, and by wetting it, it can be put in the air and it'll pull carbon out of the air at 1,000 times the rate of an actual tree and store it. And so, you know, so we could have negative emissions. So what we covered these stories in our documentary, and we are looking at, like, what is the regulatory impact on them? And so you see that almost all of them, which are ready to go from a scientific, technological perspective, for the most part, they're blocked. Mm-hmm. They're blocked. You know, you have the Cattlemen's Association lobbying with the federal government to prevent cell-cultured meat from being called meat, even though it is meat. It's chemically meat, exactly. Yeah. But they just like, oh, well, you know, they don't want it to be called meat. And, you know, there's been nothing like it, right?
Yeah.
Another example with 3D printed organs is, you know, they're regulated under the FDA under a regime of medical devices and a regime of drug regulations. But they're not a drug and they're not a device. It's something new. And so, yeah, it's really been interesting. You know, you think about regulation as something very boring. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, as a storyteller, you dive into something like that and then you see how incredibly it affects people's lives and how the world could be different with changes, you just sort of feel, to me, I'm like, there should be 100 storytellers out there working on stories like this. Like, why is it so expensive to live in San Francisco, in Silicon Valley? Why? Yeah. Well, they won't permit new buildings. They won't permit new places for people to live. They just won't, because they don't want there to be new buildings. And so, like, that is, that's why we go from the state of progress and flourishing and people being able to, you know, pursue their own happiness to a point where people are like stuck, and they're like, you know, even if these guys who are like doing this most phenomenal stuff that could help everyone are, you know, they just have a bunch of barriers in their way that are unnecessary. And that's a perfect kind of thing that storytellers, if they could dive in and cover these things in a way where people can understand what's happening, they would just demand change and the change would just happen.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So here's one thing that's interesting. So you're saying, if I understand you correctly, one, I agree with this idea of, like, you have these regulations that are impacting us, and that's, you know, not allowing us to progress, right? And it's usually by progressives, ironically, right? Or not letting us progress in any meaningful way, at least not in the way that we want to progress. Maybe that's the issue. And so you're saying that this is a place for a storyteller to dig into, like, regulations and tell stories about, hey, here's what's holding us back from a new future, a better future, or maybe just the stories that are involved with what regulation is holding back. And just digging.
Right.
But here's my question. Here's where maybe I'm going to challenge you a little bit. So if they're doing that, so let's say a storyteller does that. It sounded like you said something along the lines, if I'm wrong, correct me, please. But the audience, or the American people, will suddenly, like, if they were to see a documentary about this, or a few of them, that they'll kind of switch their views to that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, sort of. So I think, like, when we have this mental model in our head, I think, you know, just it's driven into us. It's that we're ruled by ideology, you know, where you're sort of like, well, I'm a progressive. Well, I'm a libertarian. Well, I'm a conservative, you know, and then it needles off into, like, you know, race and sex and all other different kinds of ideologies. But when you look at it with something like the 3D printed meat, you know, we interviewed the head of the World Futurists Organization. I'd never met a futurist before, Julie Steele. And, you know, her approach was this. She's just like, well, what about from the perspective of the future? You know, we think about right now and we think about the past, but what about from the perspective of the future? Well, this, let me tell you what's going to happen in the perspective of the future. We're going to make this 3D printed meat. It's going to happen. And we are going to end like lack, you know, hunger around the world. It's just, it's going to happen. You know, and this is what's going to happen. You can get on board.
I see where this is going.
Or not. Yeah. But yeah, it's going to happen. I like you know?
This. This is a good argument.
So it doesn't matter whether you're on the left or you're on the right. We have a common issue, and that is, we want to make sure that people have food, and we want to evolve to a point where as a species, we're like Spock, you know, like, yeah, I guess you could go hunt a deer and kill it and eat it or something, but like, you don't have to, we like don't have to, you know, it, you know, impose any suffering to sustain ourselves and eat. We don't have to worry about people all over the globe not having food. And it has nothing to do with your politics or anything like that. All it has to do
is
need to be free to come up with this, the stuff that works.
Well, and from what you're saying, like the issue that she's arguing that I like is this, if you stall it for 5 years, that's millions of people that didn't have to die from famine.
Exactly. And so when you sit and you're like, I'm a storyteller and I care about, you know, I care about people. I care about meaning and truth. Like, here is your truth. You know, we are in the middle of an incredible digital revolution. It is not guaranteed. You know, it is not guaranteed. Things could shut down. There's all kinds of things that could ensue. But there's something at stake that is very, very, very important. And if that doesn't, like, make you feel something in your soul and charge your imagination where you're like, I want to, like, you know, make something on this, then, you know, then why are you doing it? You know, why are you doing it? It doesn't have to, you're not motivated by politics. You're not motivated by like philosophy or like your tribe or your ideology. You're motivated by truth and you're motivated by connecting to people. And so audiences who, no matter what perspective they're coming from, you know, see a story like this. And I do feel that they're going to, you know, broadly would just say, oh my gosh, we need to like, you know, step on it. You know, give these guys some landing space. We're okay with some risk. We need to, you know, make this happen because the stakes are too high. I believe that people who, if they're given the message and the ideas, well, not really a message, but really just the information and the understanding, the empathetic feeling of what other people are going through, they will absolutely, you know, the good part of them will rise up and do something about it. And I think that's, you know, as an artist, that's what you want. You know, well, you want to touch people.
Well, let's finish up because I know you got to go in a little bit. So in our last little segment here, I want to move into art a little bit more. And because my question and my concern with that is that the people that have art opposed to what we're creating. So, for instance, I mean, think about all the disaster movies that are, you know, what's his name? The guy like did 2012 or did like The Day After Tomorrow. Who's that guy?
Right.
Yeah. You know, and there's all these, like every science fiction movie, for instance, starts with, we fucked up the planet, right? We destroyed the planet through using fossil fuels, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't even matter if it's necessary to say that. It's just like, it's almost like a quip you have to have at the beginning of anything that has to do with 5 years in the future. We destroyed the planet, right? And so what my concern is, like, it's not like I'm not as bullish on documentaries as you are, to be quite frank. I think it's art, not documentaries. It has to happen. It has to happen through, we create these worlds and we show people in practice that the future is not going to be destroyed. For instance, and just one example that, you know, like what I like about Ayn Rand is that heroes are possible. That's what I like about Margaret Mitchell's character, Scarlett O'Hara, right? She's a heroine. She's a real heroine in a real sense. Like, she's got qualities that are not normal. Normal people don't have the qualities that she has. Even though she seems like it, she went through the Civil War and she, you know, she took care of Nellie. Nellie, is that? It's been a while since I've read it.
Melanie.
Melanie with an M. Thank you. She used to call her Melly, I believe is what it was, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So she, you know, she took care of like these people. She was an actual strong hero. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, you know, what I hope I see, and you know, I haven't seen all the Talias and Nexus films because I don't know where to find them, to be honest. So,
I can tell you about that. Yeah. Okay. Well, so yes, the films have been going around to film festivals. I think we have about like 30 now produced. So, what we've recently, you mentioned Cinder Q. So we have a literary journal called Cinder Quarterly. In January, we will launch the website version of that and update the app, where we will pretty much be launching one film a month. So the films that have been made in the lab,
they're going to see. That's exciting.
Yeah, so they're going to be, you know, we have, you know, designed, you know, campaigns to support them. Yeah. So everyone will be able to check them out on CinderQ, and you can see them via the app or you can see them via the website and get it out there. I had a thought. In answer to your question or your point, which was, you know, it dawned on me recently when I was talking to my dad at Thanksgiving, you know, about Marx and the culture. And I'm like, you know, my thought process was, well, look, Marx was wrong. You know, clear. I think honestly, you know, from reading Marx, if he was born today, he would just like hands down admit that he was wrong. I think he would just be like, listen, I was born and I lived at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and there was a terrible pollution, terrible like work conditions.
He was observing something really bad. He was.
Yeah. But he didn't see that the system evolved to like solve those problems. You know, it's sort of like that's the whole engine and idea of the free market, is when you have all these people, all their brains and imaginations, and then, you know, ability for them to interact, and you have wealth increase. Well, then, yes, there's problems, but you can then turn your attention to them. You know, so for example, with, you know, let's say like climate or global warming. So, like, you know, one of our, a historian we had, Patrick Allitt, who's a historian at Emory, he made the point that, like, yes, it's a problem, but we would never have been even able to understand that it was a problem until we had reached a level of scientific and intellectual development, which only even could have possibly happened due to discovery and use of fossil fuels as an energy source, to even have the ability to measure the amount of the carbon in the air. So the question you got to ask yourself is, you know, do I believe that people can solve the problems? Do I have faith in them or not? And so I think with Marx, the most compelling thing is not like that he discovered something. It's that he developed a narrative, and that narrative is the oppression narrative. And the oppression narrative is there's an oppressed person, and then there is an oppressor, you know, proletariat capitalist. Mm-hmm. And social justice is taking whatever the oppressor has and giving it to the oppressee. And that happens through violence in his narrative. Mm-hmm. And so when I see like the tribalism that's going on today in these various ideologies, it basically amounts to reenacting this oppression narrative. And it's unfortunate that it doesn't end positively. It ends through some violence or a standstill. Now, Rand does not have the oppression narrative. She has the, if you will, Horatio Alger independence individualist narrative. And her narrative is, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you are passionate and you have a dream and you are in America and in a land that has these institutions where you're able to pursue your dream, you can do it. You can do it. And it is good for you to do it, and you should be able to do it, and you have the power, and you can do it. And I think that her narrative, that narrative, is that's the one that is the actual progressive narrative. The oppression narrative, that has progressivism as its name, is the standstill narrative. It's the we're dividing people into tribes and pitting them against one another. You know, but if I'm an individual, you know, and I can do it. Well, I think you see in Hollywood narratives like the disaster movies or whatever, you just easily pick out, well, is this an oppression narrative? You know, is that how this resolves? You know, or is this an individualist narrative? You know, and I mean, with Westerns, you know, that's like, I think, a real bastion of individualist narratives. And, you know, as an artist,
I don't know if it is anymore. I don't know if you saw the Coen brother Buster Scruggs Western-ish thing.
I haven't seen that yet.
That's very interesting. It's a whole bunch of snippets of Westerns, and they're brilliantly done. Like, it's a Coen brother, so the filmmaking is amazing. Like, it's definitely worthy of study.
Yeah.
But there's definitely some, it's not as much about the individual as it, you know, could be, I think. I mean, or they're ridiculing it in a certain way. And like, you know, one of the interesting things, for instance, I'm doing a series on the birth of science fiction and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Nathaniel Hawthorne and the Birth of Science Fiction. And one of the interesting things that I've learned in my studies of this, of science fiction, is that there was a kind of almost a branching off of different types of science fiction with H.G. Wells. So there's basically three forms of science fiction now. My favorite is the Hawthorne strain, the Hawthorne Shelley strain, Frankenstein and Rappaccini's Daughter with Hawthorne. And versus H.G. Wells, who he basically didn't care about individuals in the art itself. For instance, the time traveler doesn't have a name. Like, it's not about the time traveler.
Right.
Nobody, like, his characteristics don't matter. He just comes up with some shit. But for him, you know, he just somehow makes it. And H.G. Wells gives some kind of pseudoscience example for it. But for Wells and for most other science fiction and dystopian and utopian, and I think it's had a huge impact on Hollywood, you know, to this day, is it's about the social commentary. So even, you know, H.G. Wells' famous time traveler story is it's about the class warfare, right? Of the, the Morlocks and the Eloi. And he's even, you know, at the time, the Morlocks are underground because Wells is actually attacking the tunnel system of his own era, right? Like it's an excuse to just say, oh, well, we got problems in our own time in the future. The difference with like Frankenstein, which I think is one of the great, you know, science fiction stories of all time, and Rappaccini's Daughter. I'm a huge Nathaniel Hawthorne fan. Is that Nathaniel Hawthorne, Shelley? I know you have you used to work for somewhere called Ozymandias, right?
Right.
Yeah, and so you know, I just finished Prometheus Unbound for the first time by Percy Shelley, which was just way above my head. I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but it's beautiful. There's some beautiful passages. But my point is with these guys and the Romantics, this is what I want to be a part of bringing back. They were interested in the character, the motivations, what drove them. This is what Ayn Rand was interested in. She was interested in, you know, John Galt, for instance, is like a you know, big character. But it's all of the small characters that are impacted by him that are really critical, like the Reardons and how they act and they're not perfect. And the motivations for their actions are important. So I guess like that'll be the last thing I say if you have any last thoughts, because I think you got to go. But the idea of how can we help with the flowering? Because personally, I think documentaries are cool. They're just not, I'm just not as bullish on them, I guess, personally.
Right.
I'm more interested in showing to the world good, well, first off, good form. Like, you have to be good with your craft. So I want to see better craft in writing and you know, storytelling, which is why I can admire Coen Brothers, even though I don't like their message. But the second thing is like characters, like character driven. So not just about, like you were saying earlier, the destruction of the world, is it an individualist or is it a collectivist, I guess you could say. So
right. Yeah, well, it's been absolutely fantastic being on here, and I'm happy to do this anytime with you, Kirk, to talk about like literature and ideas and maybe even go more in depth to like some actually specific works. But I just want to echo what you're saying about, you know, just taking Gone with the Wind. So you have Scarlett O'Hara, and here is a woman who was raised to just have everything given to her. You know, she's a wealthy daughter, you know, everything was given to her. And then this war comes along, and she has to survive. Mm-hmm. And does she always do the right thing? Does she sometimes do the selfish thing, the mean thing, the bad thing? Yes, she does. Yeah. But she also does the hard thing, you know, and that's like, that's a really interesting thing. You have Melanie, who's like the sweet, good, perfect, you know, Christian virtue in that film. You know, Ashley, who represents the old Southern gentleman, always do things right. But they don't survive. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't survive. And she survives by focusing on what really matters and the practical. And she's not afraid to make mistakes. And she believes in herself. And she's willing to do what it takes. And so I think when you have characters like that, even who are in some senses, like, you know, as a Southerner from Alabama, I read passages that Scarlett says or does, and I'm just like, you traitor, you know, but on the other hand, you just gotta admire what is like a portrait of like what a modern woman should be to be great, you know? And so it's like Margaret Mitchell doesn't need to write that novel to convince us of a political position or even convince us of what a woman should be. She's just honest. to her characters, and it is driven by those characters, and it is about their moral decisions. And when you read it, it is so incredibly edifying. Mm-hmm. So I think if we can aspire to create works that rival that of Gone with the Wind, then we will be doing good.
I'm with you, man. I think that's a great way to end. I hope people at the very least go read Gone with the Wind and some of the other works that we mentioned. And thank you so much, Patrick, for being on the show. Any last things real quick you want to tell people to go visit before we go?
Yeah, sure thing. So if you're interested in the film that I mentioned that we're producing that's going to be coming out in the middle of next year, you can find out more at justaddfirewater.com, which is our production company. We also have a project called the Politically Incorrect Guide television show, Pig TV, that's going to be launching with, it's like a Ricky Gervais show, which is like an animated show, except it's a podcast like this one. So if you imagine me and Kirk animated, that's what it would be like. and that's going to be coming out early next year. Then if you're interested in the Taliesin Nexus or talent development or a place where, you know, some of these short films are coming out where you're going to get to see really experimental or really interesting films that are in this vein, like we've been discussing, the spiritual vein. Let me redo that. Hold on.
No problem.
So if you're interested in, the content, this conversation, the spiritual vein of it, you can go to talnexus.com, and in January look for cinderq.com. You can actually go on to Apple or Google and download the app CinderQ, where you will find essays, short stories, chapters of books, and short films that are going to be rolling out all next year. And just to give you a sense, one of the films that we produced last year was one of the finalists for the Student Academy Awards, the Oscars. So one of eight of the best short films, student films in the country last year came out of our program, and that's going to be rolling out on that website. So it was delightful to be here, and you can reach me through those organizations, and tell me when we get to do this again, Kirk.
Hey, I'm doing this every day, man. You tell me.
All right.
Take care, Patrick.
You have a good one. Bye. Bye.